Hubbub, a chaotic din caused by a crowd of people.
Hello and welcome to season 5, episode 5 of the Director's Podcast, Hubbub. I'm Faye Miller from Gingerbread World and my co-host is Bruce Bignall from Evolve Pipe Drive. And today we are talking to Helena Jevons from Helena Jevons Coaching and Consulting. Hi Helena, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
It's great to have you on the podcast. So we're really looking forward to finding out a bit about your business and your background, moving from the corporate world into working for yourself and all the different things you're involved in. So kick off with what you do and we'll go from there, really.
So my main business is my coaching and consulting business, Helena Jevons Coaching and Consulting, as you said. And then I have a tendency to just get interested and curious about a lot of things, and then I have to work out how many of those things I can fit into my life. So I love coaching. I started out as a very, very corporate employee, loving data, loving data segmentation, loving what data segmentation could show you in the numbers, and then you could go and dig into it with more qualitative research techniques, and then you'd find this piece of gold and you'd be like, oh, that's it, that's the thing that's going to connect this product, this service, this intention, this ambition with the consumer. That's what's going to win their hearts and minds. And I still, that's my absolute love, is finding that golden nugget of how you can connect with people and how you can kind of win hearts and minds. So that's definitely the thing that brings me both alive. And I suppose what happened for me was I jumped into the corporate world. I was in Heinz for quite a long time. So working in mainly in the baby food area. Yeah. And as I got further and further up the corporate ladder, I was actually just doing less and less of what I enjoyed doing. So that was what led me to, as well as actually reading Naomi Klein's No Logo and having a massive wake-up call about our commercial consumerist approach to life, the universe and everything. Yeah. I'm thinking, I can't do this anymore. I don't think I can do this anymore. And so from there, I really was like, well, I know that I love this piece of the Consumer Connect. How can I take that love and take it to somewhere where business or the organisational structure in which I'm working can have more of an effect and create more change and do something different and maybe challenge the establishment? So I kind of was like poacher turned gamekeeper, I think, in terms of wanting to use business as a force for good. Yeah. And I would say that's something that has underpinned my decisions since. And I have occasionally I've gone back into corporate when there's been something just really interesting. Yeah. Like, that's a really interesting challenge. I'll go back in for 6 or 12 months and try and see how that can be change shifted solved. Yeah. But generally, I just am a hugely passionate believer that small business is fleet enough of foot, is creative enough, is free enough to be able to actually be a massive agent for change in the world.
So when did you, timescales-wise, when did you actually sort of leave the corporate world and then go down this route? How long ago was that?
So that was when I was 28 and I'm now 40 something. So a fair while ago, and I got headhunted actually from Heinz. It's a longer story, but I got headhunted from Heinz to become the marketing director and then the managing director of a sex toy startup.
Nice.
So my very first move into small business was just this huge shock, actually, and I think that would be true of founders who come from big companies and think, I need to go and do my own thing now, I need to be free. And it's like, and that feels like it's super empowering and going to be really exciting, and it's going to be, you know, and actually it's like, the printer's broken. There's not an IT man, and I've got to fix the printer, but I can't fix the printer because there's no coffee left and I've got people coming. And like, just, you're just like, oh my God, everything is, as you two will know, right? Yeah. Everything is now on me.
Yeah.
And you know, I've got very limited runway because I've got a small chunk of funding, and I've got to get to a certain point if there's any chance I'll be getting more funding. I've got to keep the investors happy, and I've got to. So it was just such a culture shock. Yeah. And I think for founders who do make that change from corporate, I think I've got a strange range of experience because I worked in big corporate, and there's part of me that loves those structures and that safety and that security and that structure around me. And then there's a part of me that loves the freedom of doing completely my own thing in my own consultancy and not being answerable to anybody else. But there's a loneliness that can come with that. And then there's a part of me that likes that really early stage creative tension between two or three people who come together to try and do something really new. Yeah. And the kind of way that that tension can work or not work, and who are the right people to come together to try and do something different, and how does that all work or not work. So I kind of feel like I've got those three types of experience, and I still have a bit of those. Like, I still go back into big enterprise level businesses and consult. I do my own thing with my consultancy and coaching, and I love the coaching. I really love the coaching, and it's almost, the coaching feels to me almost like a higher version of my love of the branding and things. It's like I spent so much of that early 10 years of my career crafting brands and drawing out of them what their most beautiful iteration was like. And now to actually sit with a person and allow that to emerge from them through their own self-reflection and their own honesty and their own preparedness to go to difficult places, and, you know, just to hold that is kind of like a different iteration of the same thing, actually. A long answer to a question.
No, but it was really interesting. So you I mean, like, first of all, let's go, I'm going to straighten sex toy company. I've got to ask, was it fun working for the sex toy company?
I don't even know where to start answering that question. Yes, I mean, it was ludicrously fun and ludicrously hard. I was I mean, if you think about me too now, there wasn't anything that was like sexual impropriety, but I was the only woman in a sex toy company.
Really?
So that was funded by 36 middle-aged male investors.
Wow.
And I was sitting there having, you know, presenting from a proper pitch deck, sitting there going, so, female sexual responsiveness, this is what you need to know. And these are the issues of people who can't achieve orgasm. And these, you know, and it was just like, and I was just sitting there with a deck, like it was a deck about baby food or a deck about
so how
a travel
did that approach
business.
Come? Because this is quite interesting, right? So you were headhunted to do, at what stage was this company? Did you know some of those investors? How did they find you? What was?
I did. So a couple of people I tangentially worked with had got involved as investors in the company. And I went out for some drinks with them. And two of them were giggling in the corner of this bar. And I just, I've got quite strong intuition, but I don't necessarily know that's what it is when things come out of my mouth. And so they were giggling in the corner, and I'm like, oh, for God's sake, what are you two up to now? Like, don't tell me you're going to go and challenge Anne Summers or something. And they looked like they had been.
Oh, really? Because you'd hit the nail on the head and they didn't.
And I was like, oh, my God, you are. You're going to go and take on Anne Summers. I'm like, you need a marketing director. So, I mean, headhunter is probably a strong word because I made a lucky guess in a bar and then said, can I come, Peter? So, because I was just also at the point where I was like, I'm doing less and less of what I love as I go up this corporate ladder. And how often is the chance going to come along to do something like that crazy? So it was at the point where a very, very talented product designer had come up with the idea that the insight behind it. So I'm big on always starting with what is the insight for this product or this market or for this proposition. The insight was most women only achieve orgasm through clitoral stimulation. Lots of women are not. Penetrative orgasmic, because I can go straight back into it, even though it's a bit phenomenal. So what if, and I love what if as a question, what if we could create a vibrator that didn't vibrate, wasn't penetrative, and touched you like a lover touches you? Would it work?
Yeah.
Would it be interesting? So the point at which I got involved, very long way to get around to your question, was... they had started to raise a first funding round of £150,000. They knew they needed a woman involved. And they had a Lego model of the device.
Holy moly.
That's the basis on which we raised the first £150,000. A Lego model of a vibrator.
So is this mail order or is this online orders?
Well, if you remember back to, you know, when I was 28, it was the year that we actually launched the product was the year the first iPod came out.
Okay.
So you're going back to...
iPod?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're going back to a time when there wasn't the digital connectivity that we have now. So yes, on the basis of a Lego model, we raised £150,000. Oh. That took us through to getting a first prototype made from a manufacturer in China, who at the time had no idea that we were making a vibrator, because culturally that was quite a difficult conversation.
Yeah.
And I spent quite a lot of time travelling to and from China making this massager. and coming back and talking to investors, and then we raised another big funding round of about £1 million, I think it was, on the basis of the prototypes. So that was my first experience of being a founder. And then I ended up getting made redundant. So that was my first experience of something not working out.
No, but I suppose, despite it not working out, you say your first experience of being a founder, that probably gave you an awful lot of experience, all jokes aside about it being a sex toy company, everything. But it must have given you loads of experience in terms of fundraising and what entails, you know, building your own business from scratch, basically.
In terms of fundraising, in terms of shareholder agreements, in terms of, you know, directorial agreements, in terms of reverse vesting schedules, in terms of all the stuff that is really important if you're then trying to create a company where you are going to be raising that. You know, in hindsight, I would have had no idea about any of that, right? And so then, when I wanted to continue to work with small businesses, because just their fleetness of foot was so much greater, and is even greater now in the digital world that we're in, because it's such a leveler, right? Yeah. You've just got if you didn't have a £5 million advertising budget back in the day, then you didn't have a £5 million. There wasn't a way to get to people.
Yeah.
Whereas now,
you've had all these platforms, haven't
you? Absolutely. So it's very... very, very leveling. So, yeah, absolutely. The experience was invaluable, but also the damage to my little fragile, you know, 30-year-old self.
I wanted to say, actually, so what's your response at that point? Do you just run back to corporate? Do you say, actually, I'm pretty good at this? Like, what internally?
I didn't feel good at it at that point. I didn't have, it probably took me 8 or 10 years after that to realise what I had learned from it, where I had been incredibly naive, where I hadn't put people around me who could help me look after myself in that very male investor environment, where I hadn't, you know, I didn't get that at the time. I was just feeling like a failure and having all of those feelings that anyone, whatever the circumstances of redundancy, that always going to have a psychological impact on you. And so, no, at that point, I initially did exactly what you said, which is like, okay, I was good at food, I'm going to go back to food. So there happened to be a very interesting project going on with Heinz's biggest competitor, actually, Premier Foods.
Okay.
And they wanted somebody to come in and do some work on their Branston brand and launch Branston into... They were launching Branston and, into beans and ketchup and brown sauce and really taking on Heinz.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that sounds quite fun. So I did that for a bit, but I left for the same reason that I left Heinz, which is...
Not doing as much of what you love.
And also, you know, I just got to the point, I mean, you obviously write a lot of copy fail, you write a lot of copy for a lot of really interesting things, but I was just like, I just don't think I can write any more pack copy for the back of a packet of food. And that's no disrespect to people who love doing that, but I was just like, I think I need to.
And you'd tasted outside, you'd smelt fresh air.
You'd smell the fresh air.
Yeah. I think you can be passionate, you can enjoy things like that, but it doesn't actually, you're not always passionate about it, like, you know. I don't particularly enjoy writing about slurry pumps or POS systems and stuff like that. I can find a sort of interest in it, like, but not passionate about it, like I'm about my own business, probably.
Yeah. I think that's really true. And so I went back and did a very short-term contract because I knew it and because it felt safe and because that was a good thing for me to do psychologically. And then from there, I went back into another... it wasn't a complete startup, but it was a baby food company doing baby food very, very differently. So it was doing baby food with fair trade, organic ingredients. It was doing baby food with quinoa, not refined wheat. It was doing baby food with... So it felt like it was that change thing again. It was like, let's take what exists to the next level. Let's just change the market fundamentally from where it has been for the last 60 years. Yeah. So again, that was food. So I guess there's probably a comfort level in I'm going into food again. But there was that sense of... what we do with this is in our own gift. It's not constrained by corporate investors or needing to give double-digit profit returns or any of those kind of things. So,
so you did that with the baby food company. And how long were you there for? What happened after that? When did you eventually sort of move into your own sphere?
So after the baby food company, it's interesting, isn't it? Like, I've been talking to people a lot about directive strategy versus emergent strategy, because I do a lot of strategy work with companies. And so I guess I would now have to frame this as a bit of an emergent phase in my life, because again, somebody I used to work with at Heinz contacted me and said, I've gone to work for this amazing startup charity in Amsterdam. We need a marketing director. Do you fancy coming and joining us? And again, I was like, I'm just so interested in so many different things that I went and lived in Amsterdam for nearly 2 years and headed up the global launch of this kids charity and had an amazing time. You know, like, we got McKinsey to pro bono consult with us. You know, I just used to write these letters that are cheeky letters. So McKinsey did all our strategic business planning stuff. I wrote to the biggest advertising agency in Amsterdam and they came and did all our branding. And so it was just like, it's a different thing. And I love it when I have a lot of money to pay a really great agency to do something. I also love it when I can like persuade somebody into a dream. And so that was persuading people into a dream, which is, how can you enable children to be change makers in countries all over the world? So that had been piloted in 10 countries and we were launching it globally. And that's, I think, now about 140 companies, 140 countries. So it goes into the national curriculum. It teaches children about spending, saving, planning, budgeting, working together to achieve social change and environmental change in their communities. And what starts to happen, so I coined this phrase that we managed to get the Deputy Director of UNICEF to use in the launch meeting, which was trickle up. So obviously trickle down economically has been widely vaunted and largely, I would say, has been deemed as failure. I was like, well, what about trickle up? What about, you know, the change that can be affected by children in their communities? So, yeah, and actually that strand of my interest lay dormant for quite a while, but I've now got a 9-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I have just created a curriculum to go into year five that I'm not going to jinx it by saying anything, but should be launching within the next 3 or 4 months with 3 or 4 schools. Fantastic. Which is a 12-week module where the time is taken from maths and PSHE time. But instead of being taught sort of the abstract things that they can often be taught in that time, they're being taught a 12-week entrepreneurial curriculum where they actually launch their own businesses, look at the competition, and then they have a culmination event where they sell whatever services or products they've made. And then the next 12-week is, right, now you've made the money from that, let's teach you, how do you save for the future? You've got this money, however much it is. Let's look at different savings profiles, different risk profiles, different, you know, putting some in some very safe savings account, what you could do. Do you want to go and dabble with something that's a bit more risky? So that when they're that age, when they're just so absorbing everything like a sponge, that's part of what they're learning.
Which is a fantastic thing, really, because I think, you know, it's so true. School is, like maths, you say, is, and science and all those things, they're quite abstract. But you don't, I mean, I certainly didn't when I was at school, but that was back in the dark ages anyway. But doing, you know, like back in the 80s, and they didn't do anything to do with, you know, finances other than an abstract form or investing or entrepreneurialism or anything like that, which are all things which are really important. I mean, you probably need to know less about algebra than more about how to sort your pensions out and
compound interest.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was fortunate that I had some time to be able to work on that, and I was able to have some connections who are likely to be able to get that to start with me. But I would love, out of this podcast, to find my tribe of people who would like to come in around that, because you know, people like Martin Lewis are doing an amazing job with older children and with adults in terms of financial education, but it's a huge gap in
it's
our curriculum.
It's massive, isn't it? It's a massive, massive gap.
And, you know, entirely. The kids, they'll get it at that age, and it's actually more, arguably, more, I'm not a pedagogue, so I'm not an expert in this field, but my children are much more interested in learning anything when it's got a practical context and when they might earn some money from it and when, you know, they're creating something.
Yeah. Well, my daughter is a case in point, which is a site, she's done just that. She got her child trust fund money when she turned 18. And she actually stuck it into a stocks and shares ISA. So she's using the interest that she earns off her ISA now, the money that she invested, to fund her travelling and whatever else she wants to do. But she's quite clever doing that. But most, like, my stepdaughter doesn't. She was like, oh my God, how are you doing that? She didn't understand. She'd never seen it before. And that's the thing. She could have done the same thing had she known about it. But she Phoebe went off and found this stuff out herself, but most kids don't do that.
Well, and you know, kids are different, right? Yeah. Like, my children are so different. Yeah. Like, my son is a saver, different. My daughter is a spender. Yeah. Like, I just can see it. I'm the same mother, they're just different children.
Well, Phoebe's a spender. She's just figured out a way of doing it that doesn't cost her too much money, well, basically.
It retains the capital, right?
And yeah, exactly.
So she's got her goose that's laying her golden eggs, and she's realised that let's not kill the goose.
Yeah, precisely.
But, you know, most of us understand finance, or historically have understood finance, in the way that our parents did or didn't understand finance, yes. because they're the dominant people who do that. You know, I invest in property as soon as I could buy a property, because I was brought up being told that, you know, property is a really safe, secure, long-term investment.
Yeah.
So it took me quite a while to realise, well, no, actually the message in that wasn't the literal message of invest in property, it was invest in something that's secure, and then, you know, think about your risk profile around that in terms of what you want to do with the other bits of these.
So that's rolling out in four schools.
I'm looking around for anything wooden to touch at this point. Hopefully within the next 3 or 4 months.
Brilliant.
Yes. And, you know, I'm having some quite interesting conversations about people in and around Brighton who have got children of around that age, and everybody's like, oh my God, it's so needed. So that's really nice. I mean, that's not paying me any money, but that's like, it's just important.
It's absolutely essential. I think you're onto something there, because it is such a, it is something I've banged on about. I've done anything about it like you have, but it's something that me and my other half talk about. Oh God, they don't get any financial, there's no financial training at school for real life stuff, basically. You know, it's all very well working out how many pears and how many apples someone bought and how many sold and how many are left over, which I kind of is a bit, but you know, some of it, I've been sitting there doing maths training, you know, revision with my 15-year-old for her GCSEs, and some of the stuff I'm thinking, yeah, we're doing it, but she's never going to use any of this in the real world. It's not relevant, you know.
No, and then the bit that, again, you know, I've kind of feel a bit like, ooh, I've got the opportunity to, and it's ridiculously grandiose, but, you know, I'm thinking, oh, like, how, if this becomes successful, then through this curriculum, there's the opportunity not only to teach children how to manage their finances, but it's actually to be able to teach them from the age of 10 how to create a business that not only makes money, but can also do some social and environmental good, because that's as part of it. It's like, what is the responsibility of a business owner to their community, their region, their planet, their, you know, how does that all ripple out from?
And I get the impression for you, that's quite a fundamental part of what you do, is not just obviously helping people to realise their goals and with mentorship and that, but doing it in a way that carries some kind of social, environmental responsibility and sustainability to it as well. That's something that's quite key.
It is, and it has been a big challenge for me, because one of the opportunities that came my way just over a year ago now was the opportunity to be a founder of a travel company.
Yeah.
Now, anyone who's involved in a travel company at this time on the planet with the challenges that we face has got to do, I had to do, that's all I can say. I had to do a lot of self-reflection as to did I or didn't I want to be involved in a travel company at this point on the planet. And I'm still doing that self-reflection as I'm working in the travel company. Where I have got to it at the moment, and I fully expect it will continue to change, is that I think there are very big margins being taken by some travel companies and people don't realise that. Mm. So I think for me, at a time when people's finances generally are so stretched, you know, wherever you are in society, there are more calls on whatever money you have. For people being able to travel, I've got a friend who, you know, do you have children as well?
Not yet, no.
Even when you do, there's this form that you fill in at school if you're taking the children out of school for any reason. And it's like, I'm taking them out for like, and generally it's not particularly great reasons, right? And taking them out for a great reason, like a holiday in term time, is extremely frowned on. And I'm not advocated for a moment that children should unnecessarily miss school. But, you know, some of my friends have started to add a box, which is, I'm taking them out of school to give them an experience that is impossible to have at school, which is travel.
I think it should be mandatory. Like, if at all possible, then come back and tell the class what you learned. Like, the reflection of what was different about what you saw, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's the conflict for me, is it has been in us as humans since, getting quite grandiose, the dawn of time, to want to see what is over that next mountain, what is across that sea, how do different people do things, what can we learn from things. And that genie is out of the bottle. That's innately in us to want to go and explore and see. And so, despite all of the massive challenges around, you know, fuel subsidies and fossil fuels and all of that, which would be a whole other podcast, people want to travel. And so if I can be part of an organisation that helps them travel and helps particularly their children be able to experience other cultures and have those experiences that you can't get going to school every day, you can't, or going to work every day. You know, we know as business owners probably how differently we can operate if we're in a particular co-working space or a different co-working space, or we go to a bar or we hang out with our friends, or we go and, you know, sit in a cabin in nature for a day. Or those different environments shape us and help us understand more about, I think, our humanness at our best. And so that's how I'm squaring that circle at the moment, is that if I can help people travel and through the way we shape that brand and shape that communication is we can meet people where they're at with their love of travel, facilitate people travelling, and while they're travelling, we can educate about environmental impacts of travel, social impacts of travel, connecting with community, and we can shape travel in a different way. So there's less what's called parachute tourism, which is you book your inclusive, you go and sit in the hotel, and then you go out again in an international hotel that takes all the money, not the regional economy. Then that's potentially really powerful. Mm. So, does that answer your question?
I guess so.
I think so. No, we said, what was your name? And then we.
I
think that there's a really interesting. I actually want to know about the project of getting anything onto a curriculum, and so what's that been like? So obviously you said it was maths and something else is what you tried to hop onto. What are the challenges there? And because, and even throwing in the word bit like entrepreneur into the curriculum and or savings or interest into the curriculum, where do you begin to have those conversations? Like what's the, who do you approach it to begin with? And
so
what's the response been?
The response has been very mixed. I haven't reached out to lots of schools yet. I have bounced it off a few friendly teachers that I know who were the ones who said, well, yes, the way we could accommodate. So they gave me guidance about, well, how deep could the course go? How much could it cover? How much time could be available if teachers were willing to use certain curriculum chunks of time in this way? And the response that I got was, well, given what you've scoped out here, if we flesh it out a bit more, where it can fit in the curriculum with us taking time and it doing what we need to do in that curriculum time for that year group is by taking those two time blocks. So I wasn't going in saying, can you do this as well? I wasn't doing it going in saying, can you do this after school or can you do it as a lunch club? Because I wasn't asking for any more time from teachers. And effectively, whenever I have the conversation about the importance of this piece of education, everybody goes, well, of course they should be learning that. So it's not a difficult sell. No, I'm not trying to sell something that people don't believe should be happening. I'm trying to sell something that everybody's like, oh, it's a no-brainer. So it's not hard to sell. And teachers, of course, want the kids to have the skills they need. They, of course, they have curriculum constraints because there's a national curriculum, but they can use that time in different ways they want. So it's again, it's perfectly possible that I go and talk to a different school or a different, you know, person within the education authority or ESCC or whoever it is, and they go, oh, well, we could put that in these two modules, or actually we don't think that's appropriate for that year group, it should be a year six learning project. Or so it could go in differently. And then actually, you know, I'm a coach, so I have a coach. And my coach is just like, why are you trying to put it in a school at all? Like, if you want kids to learn this, why don't you just launch it online? YouTube, and I'm like, you know, I hadn't thought about that. And that was partly because of having worked within an organisation that did a similar thing. Yeah. And therefore having just pulled that model off the shelf. Mm. Whereas, of course, there's a million different models. And I just hadn't gone there in my own little box. Thinking.
I think that's where I was trying, like, because if it's that hard to crack that nut, there are so many other avenues to get that out there. And, you know, whether it's maybe it starts with an online course of sorts, which then leads into local communities, which then they're the drivers for the change, because it's actually the adults working with the kids. So you're not taking up any teacher time, But I think it's, did it used to be called Home Economics, or am I mixing something up?
No, that was
just senior school. There was definitely Home Economics.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think, because there was, but it's been lost. But
you did price up like a recipe, didn't you? You did have to do maths. You're right.
There was something there, but it never really, the story didn't go deep enough for you to care. And now we spoke a little bit before we started recording about kind of entrepreneurship, business owners, founders. I was never knew what a business owner was when I was growing up. You know, that wasn't a thing. We now hear about it all the time. Yeah. Hustle, hustle, hustle. You know, just do this, start your own thing.
It wasn't talked about when you were at school. It certainly wasn't when I was at school. It was all about get a job, be a solicitor, something like that.
And that's so interesting, because I've just been going around secondary schools with my daughter to choose a secondary school for next year. And absolutely, what is still hammered in that head teacher's speech to the potential new recruit to the school, that's not the right word, is it? The new joiners.
Yeah.
Lost my words. Inmates. A bit strong. And we will prepare your child for the extremely competitive job market. Yeah. And I'm like, oh my God, is that still the narrative?
But it's still, I think
so. For an 10 or 11 year old, that's the narrative. And I'm like, oh, that's, but, you know, the speed with which education, I mean, you can get, I don't know, a whole series of podcasts on education as well, talking about fitness for purpose. You know, the world is just, and it's not, I don't think it's the government's fault, or education, or teachers. I just don't. My parents are both teachers, so I know what it's like to work within that structure. But it's hard, and there's a lag between what entrepreneurs are learning about the world. Yeah. You know, at the moment, learning about AI, learning about whatever. For that to trickle down through government policy and get executed in schools.
By the time we reach AI, we've moved on enormously, and
so. Yeah. You know, my friends who've got kids, my kids' ages, we've got brilliant schools. We're super, super lucky in terms of what our education system does for the schools that we have happened to have available to us, very fortunately. But we're going, well, okay, what are the skills we're going to need to build around this for where the world's going to be in 10 years' time? Yeah. And possibly being on that entrepreneurial edge, we're quite well placed to equip our kids with those skills, even if they're not the skills that the national curriculum is hammering home.
I think you'd hit the nail on the head there, because I think the national curriculum is one thing, and it's worthy, it has its place, but I also think it's quite narrow in its scope, isn't it? Because it's sort of like, it takes that quite academic route and teaching these subjects, but without doing so much around all those other, like you said, the entrepreneurial side of things and the different options, learning about finances as well, but, you know, giving those alternative options. It's not a one size, it shouldn't be a one size fits all thing, but it feels it is a bit like that, and that almost marginalises some of the kids that would perhaps benefit more from an alternative way of learning, or a more entrepreneurial style of understanding. Yeah, you know, because there's plenty of people that have gone on to be hugely successful but failed miserably at school, you know. I think schools are missing the point on that. And I'm not saying blaming the schools at all. As you say, it's more endemic, it's a whole society problem, but I think there's a lot of scope for change there.
What is the education that kids need now at the age of 10 or 11 that is going to be appropriate for them in 10 years' time? It's really hard to know the shape of the world in 10 years' time, because there's so much more uncertainty than there's historically been. There's uncertainty economically, there's uncertainty environmentally, there's uncertainty in technology. And so giving the kids those skills to deal with uncertainty is actually a big part of what they need. And that's very different than the exam system, which is, learn these things in this way for this result to get an A.
Exactly.
And that's really great to give kids a focus and a goal and something to strive for and to achieve their potential. But it's completely different than this goes.
Do you think there's more scope for business leaders getting involved? I know you talked about trickle-down effect, so to speak, but actually getting involved in education to sort of say, we want kids to learn. I mean, I did a report on it recently about AI and the future of AI, and they spoke to the leader of various different major AI businesses, including Microsoft, and the idea that these leaders were saying what they need employers specifically to do, and then filtering down from there, education, what they would like to see happening in education over the next coming years in relation to generative AI specifically, not just the whole education system. But do you think that leaders, business leaders, some of the leading companies around the world and the UK need to get more involved in this stuff then?
I think that's a really good question. I don't immediately have a really good answer for it. I think that the key difference in education now than historically, and obviously I grew up with, you know, I grew up with a mum who taught maths and further maths and physics, so I didn't have any stuff about women not being able to do numbers or science, and a dad who taught humanities, so I had all of that wonderfulness at home in an analogue age. School is brilliant for learning how to work with people, how to interact with people, build friendships and all of that kind of stuff. Kids are already savvy enough to go, but Mum, I can learn whatever it is I want to learn from the best person in the world, who's the biggest expert on this, online. What is now the function of someone who has an absolute... I mean, the teachers at my kids' school are so brilliant and so passionate and so committed, but my kids are starting to see through it. They're like, hold on, I can... What? Yeah. Who... And there's... Kids are just different these days. I mean, I wouldn't have challenged my parents for a million years.
We wouldn't have done, but we didn't have access to all that stuff on the internet. Of course not. So,
and they've gone through COVID, so they've had 2 years where they did learn whatever they wanted to learn online, and they know they can learn online, which kids before that didn't know. So they're like, well, why can't we just learn the stuff we want to learn online, Mummy, like we did in COVID? And I'm like, because that's not the way the world is structured yet.
Yes.
But, you know, think, you know, what if, what will the world be like in 10 years time or 20 years time?
Yeah. We're sort of coming to the end of the podcast, so just move it back to mentorship, because I know we sort of got quite interesting talk about education, but going back to the mentoring that you do, how do you run your mentoring? What gives you most satisfaction out of it? What do you like to encourage your mentees to do, or is it all sorts of different things you get them? They come to you with a problem and help and guidance. How does it work, basically?
It's enormously varied. Yeah. So the work that I'm doing at the moment is a lot of scale up business work, where they've got to what I call an inflection point. So I have a part of my business that's called inflection consulting, and there are certain creaky points that as founders scale their businesses are like, I'm starting to use the language of acupuncture points.
Okay.
So, like, what are the points which are the ones that, if you hit them right, will unlock our whole system? And if they're blocked, block our whole system. I haven't quite worked out what to do the imagery around that language yet, but that, you know, that's what I see an inflection point as. So, a lot of people find me when they're at an inflection point.
Yeah.
And they come to me with all sorts of things, and they've heard about me in all sorts of ways. So, again, that's very emergent. That's not something that I go out and chase a certain type of person down with, but they're at that point. Yeah. That is the common. Another part of my business that, again, I just observed when I was working at an innovation centre that people get very stuck in is knowing what grants are available, what grants are available to them as an additional income stream. So I have an organisation where I have a couple of associates called Grant Doctors.
Yeah.
So I do a lot of grant writing for different types of organisation. I love that. I love finding the argument again. With regard to the mentor, come back to the mentoring, there's mentoring and then there's coaching and then there's consultancy, I think. So the bit that I'm growing to love the most is the coaching bit, actually, which is the sort of poking in the right places for people to find their own answers. So is that the answer?
Yeah, I guess so. That gives you quite a lot. Sounds like that gives you quite a lot of satisfaction. You've seen people sort of, as you say, sort of just you're poking them a little bit to get them to where they need to go. You must get a lot of satisfaction out of seeing them actually achieve those.
It's asking the right question, though. Yeah. It's like, and it's almost like, I don't know if you ever, did you ever watch Columbo? So, years and years ago. So he was one of my mum's favourite TV programmes. And so he had a habit of, he was a detective, and he used to go in and he used to ask questions about the crime that needed solving. He had this awful trench coat.
Yeah, his dirty trench coat. I can't remember, but
anyway, he was quite a character. But he always used to ask the questions, and then as he was leaving, he almost always used to turn back through the door and go, just one more thing, and it would be that question that was the killer question. That like sort of was almost the afterthought, and that often happens. Really, really often happens.
What is that? Just one more thing, and that's when you.
Well, it's just like you go, hold on, just can I just ask you this? And then that's often the penny drop moment. And unless you have the time up to that, it's always like, again, back to the word emergent. Something emerges, and then at the end, it's like, oh, it's that.
Yeah,
and then that's the shift.
It's the wood from the trees. Like it's you can spend all the time with those individual moments together, but it's the wood from the trees that actually you couldn't have asked that single question on its own at the beginning.
You have the context, no? Yeah. So it all gives me joy. And I guess the stage I'm at the moment is I'm at an inflection point where I'm really recognising I need to build my tribe around each of these.
Yeah.
Because the financial stuff is an inflection point, right? Yeah. If you can hit kids at that age with this information, that is potentially going to change a whole system.
Yeah.
If you can show people where grants are, that can unlock their growth, especially when there's you know, the budget constraints and all the kind of things that are going on for businesses. So I guess I operate in inflection, increasingly in inflection points. And businesses come to me at their inflection points. And then sometimes mentoring is appropriate, sometimes consulting is appropriate, and sometimes coaching is appropriate. But I now need to find my teams of people around those things in order for them to be scalable. So that's the stage I'm at.
That's your future, your immediate future is finding those teams and finding those tribes and that work for you then.
Yes, and then that should enable me to, you know, work on a travel company. Because we're fundraising for that at the moment. Oh. So the investor meetings for that are taking.
So good luck with that anyway. So I think we are coming to the end of the podcast now. It's been fantastic talking to you, Helena. We could honestly just sit here and talk about education. We could probably
so
do
many
a
more,
whole
so many more
I know. Yeah. We could do like a series on education and where it could be improved upon and stuff like that. But amongst
I might
others.
Have to hire you as a podcast host. No podcast like that.
Well, I should be starting my own podcast, but I never do. So there you go. Anyway, it's been great. Where can we find you online and on social media?
You can find me at helenajevons.com.
Brilliant.
And all my other projects are linked through that.
So lovely. All right, awesome. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been a joy. Thank you.
Hubbub, the Directors Hub podcast, sponsored by the Sussex Business Show.